While subjective reports cannot entirely be relied on, they do provide valuable clues for future studies. One person was able to switch her synesthesia on or off by starting or stopping her drug regimen. She detested the antidepressant Wellbutrin because it deprived her of the sensory magic that synesthesia provided. The world looked drab without it. I have been using the word cross-wiring somewhat loosely, but until we know exactly what's going on at the cellular level, the more neutral term cross-activation might be better. We know, for instance, that adjacent brain regions often inhibit each other's activity. This inhibition serves to minimize crosstalk and keeps areas insulated from one another. What if there were a chemical imbalance of some kind that reduces this inhibition, say, the blocking of an inhibitory neurotransmitter or a failure to produce it? In this scenario, there would not be any extra wires in the brain, but the synesthete's wires would not be properly insulated. The result would be the same, synesthesia. We know that, even in a normal brain, extensive neural connections exist between regions that lie far apart. The normal function of these is unknown, as with most brain connections, but a mere strengthening of these connections, or a loss of inhibition, might lead to the kind of cross-activation I suggest. In light of the cross-activation hypothesis, we can now also start to guess why Francesca had such powerful emotional reactions to mundane textures. All of us have a primary touch map in the brain called the primary somatosensory cortex, or S1. When I touch you on the shoulder, touch receptors in your skin detect the pressure and send a message to your S1. You feel the touch. Similarly, when you touch different textures, a neighboring touch map, S2, is activated. You feel the textures, the dry grain of a wooden deck, the slippery wetness of a bar of soap. Such tactile sensations are fundamentally external, originating from the world outside your body. Another brain region, the insula, maps internal feelings from your body. Your insula receives continuous streams of sensation from receptor cells in your heart, lungs, liver, viscera, bones, joints, ligaments, fascia, and muscles, as well as from specialized receptors in your skin that sense heat, cold, pain, sensual touch, and perhaps tickle and itch as well. Your insula uses this information to represent how you feel in relation to the outside world and your immediate environment. Such sensations are fundamentally internal and comprise the primary ingredients of your emotional state. As a central player in your emotional life, your insula sends signals to and receives signals from other emotional centers in your brain, including the amygdala, the autonomic nervous system, powered by the hypothalamus, and the orbitofrontal cortex, which is involved in nuanced emotional judgments. In normal people, these circuits are activated when they touch certain emotionally charged objects. Caressing, say, a lover, would generate complex feelings of ardor, intimacy, and pleasure. Squeezing a lump of feces, in contrast, likely leads to strong feelings of disgust and revulsion. Now think of what would happen if there were an extreme exaggeration of these very connections, linking S2, the insula, the amygdala, and the orbitofrontal cortex. You would expect to see precisely the sort of touch-triggered complex emotions that Francesca experiences when she touches denim, silver, silk, or paper, things that would leave most of us unmoved. Incidentally, Francesca's mother also has synesthesia. But in addition to emotions, she reports taste sensations in response to touch. For example, caressing a wrought iron fence evokes an intense salty flavor in her mouth. This too makes sense. The insula receives strong taste input from the tongue. With the idea of cross-activation, we seem to be homing in on a neurological explanation for number color and textural synesthesia. But as other synesthetes showed up in my office, we realized that there are many more forms of the condition. In some people, days of the week or months of the year produced colors. Monday might be green, Wednesday pink, and December yellow. No wonder many scientists thought they were crazy. But, as I said earlier, I've learned over the years to listen to what people say. In this particular case, I realized that the only thing days of the week, months, and numbers have in common is the concept of numerical sequence or ordinality. So in these individuals, unlike Becky and Susan, perhaps it is the abstract concept of numerical sequence that evokes the color, rather than the visual appearance of the number. Why the difference between the two types of synesthetes? To answer this, we have to return to brain anatomy. After the shape of a number is recognized in your fusiform, the message is relayed further on to your angular gyrus, a region in your parietal lobes involved, among other things, in higher color processing. The idea that some types of synesthesia might involve the angular gyrus is consistent with an old clinical observation that this structure is involved in cross-sensory synthesis. In other words, it is thought that this is a grand junction where information about touch, hearing, and vision flow together to enable the construction of high-level percepts. For example, a cat purrs and is fluffy, touch, it purrs and meows, hearing, and it has a certain appearance, vision, and fishy breath, smell, all of which are evoked by the memory of a cat or the sound of the word cat. No wonder patients with damage here lose the ability to name things, anomia, even though they can recognize them. They have difficulty with arithmetic, which, if you think about it, also involves cross-sensory integration. In kindergarten, you learn to count with your fingers, after all. Indeed, if you touch the patient's finger and ask her which one it is, she often can't tell you. All of these bits of clinical evidence strongly suggest that the angular gyrus is the great center in the brain for sensory convergence and integration. So perhaps it's not so outlandish, after all, that a flaw in the circuitry could lead to colors being quite literally evoked by certain sounds. According to clinical neurologists, the left angular gyrus in particular may be involved in juggling numerical quantity, sequences, and arithmetic. When this region is damaged by stroke, the patient can recognize numbers and can still think reasonably clearly, but he has difficulty with even the simplest arithmetic. He can't subtract 7 from 12. I have seen patients who cannot tell you which of two numbers, 3 or 5, is larger. Here we have the perfect arrangement for another type of cross-wiring. The angular gyrus is involved in color processing and numerical sequences. Could it be that in some synesthetes, the crosstalk occurs between these two higher areas near the angular gyrus rather than lower down in the fusiform? If so, that would explain why, in them, even abstract number representations or the idea of a number prompted by days of the week or months will strongly manifest color. In other words, depending on which part of the brain the abnormal synesthesia gene is expressed, you get different types of synesthetes: higher synesthetes driven by numerical concept and lower synesthetes driven by visual appearance alone. Given the multiple back-and-forth connections between brain areas, it is also possible that numerical ideas about sequentiality are sent back down to the fusiform gyrus to evoke colors. In 2003, I began a collaboration with Ed Hubbard and Jeff Boynton from the Salk Institute for Biological Studies to test these ideas with brain imaging. The experiment took 4 years, but we were finally able to show that in grapheme color synesthetes, the color area V4 lights up even when you present colorless numbers. This cross-activation would never happen in you or me. In recent experiments carried out in Holland, researchers Ramke Rowe and Stephen Schulte found that there were substantially more axons, wires, linking V4 and the grapheme area in lower synesthetes compared to the general population. And even more remarkably, in higher synesthetes, they found a greater number of fibers in the general vicinity of the angular gyrus. This all is precisely what we had proposed. The fit between prediction and subsequent confirmation rarely proceeds so smoothly in science. The observations we had made so far broadly support the cross-activation theory and provide an elegant explanation of the different perceptions of higher and lower synesthetes. But there are many other tantalizing questions we can ask about the condition. What if a letter synesthete were bilingual and knew two languages with different alphabets, such as Russian and English? The English P and the Cyrillic P represent more or less the same phoneme, sound, but look completely dissimilar. Would they evoke the same or different colors? Is the grapheme alone critical, or is it the phoneme? Maybe in lower synesthetes, it's the visual appearance that drives it, whereas in higher synesthetes, it's the sound. And what about uppercase versus lowercase letters, or letters depicted in cursive writing? Do the colors of two adjacent graphemes run or flow into each other, or do they cancel each other out? To my knowledge, none of these questions have been adequately answered yet, which means we have many exciting years of synesthesia research ahead of us. Fortunately, many new researchers have joined us in the enterprise, including Jamie Ward, Julia Simner, and Jason Mattingly. There is now a whole thriving industry on the subject. Let me tell you about one last patient. In Chapter 2, we noted that the fusiform gyrus represents not only shapes like letters of the alphabet, but faces as well. Thus, shouldn't we expect there to be cases in which a synesthete sees different faces as possessing intrinsic colors? We recently came across a student, Robert, who reported experiencing exactly that. He usually saw the color as a halo around the face, but when he was inebriated, the color would become much more intense and spread into the face itself. To find out if Robert was being truthful, we did a simple experiment. I asked him to stare at the nose of a photograph of another college student and asked Robert what color he saw around the face. Robert said the student's halo was red. I then briefly flashed either red or green dots on different locations in the halo. Robert's gaze immediately darted toward a green spot, but only rarely toward a red one. In fact, he claimed not to have seen the red spots at all. This provides compelling evidence that Robert really was seeing halos. On a red background, green would be conspicuous, while red would be almost imperceptible. To add to the mystery, Robert also had Asperger syndrome, a high-functioning form of autism. This made it difficult for him to understand and read people's emotions. He could do so through intellectual deduction from the context, but not with the intuitive ease most of us enjoy. Yet for Robert, every emotion also evoked a specific color. For example, anger was blue and pride was red. So his parents taught him very early in life to use his colors to develop a taxonomy of emotions to compensate for his deficit. Interestingly, when we showed him an arrogant face, he said it was purple and therefore arrogant. It later dawned on all three of us that purple is a blend of red and blue, evoked by pride and aggression, and the latter two, if combined, would yield arrogance. Robert hadn't made this connection before. Could it be that Robert's whole subjective color spectrum was being mapped in some systematic manner onto his spectrum of social emotions? If so, could we potentially use him as a subject to understand how emotions and complex blends of them are represented in the brain? For example, are pride and arrogance differentiated solely on the basis of the surrounding social context? Or are they inherently distinct subjective qualities? Is a deep-seated insecurity also an ingredient of arrogance? Are the whole spectrum of subtle emotions based on various combinations in different ratios of a small number of basic emotions? Recall from Chapter 2 that color vision in primates has an intrinsically rewarding aspect that most other components of visual experience do not elicit. As we saw, the evolutionary rationale for neurally linking color with emotion was probably initially to attract us to ripe fruits and/or tender new shoots and leaves, and later to attract males to swollen female rumps. I suspect that these effects arise through interactions between the insula and higher brain regions devoted to color. If the same connections are abnormally strengthened and perhaps slightly scrambled in Robert, this would explain why he saw many colors as strongly tinged with arbitrary emotional associations. By now, I was intrigued by another question. What's the connection, if any, between synesthesia and creativity? The only thing they seem to have in common is that both are equally mysterious. Is there truth to the folklore that synesthesia is more common in artists, poets, and novelists, and perhaps in creative people in general? Could synesthesia explain creativity? Vasily Kandinsky and Jackson Pollock were synesthetes, and so was Vladimir Nabokov. Perhaps the higher incidence of synesthesia in artists is rooted deep in the architecture of their brains. Nabokov was very curious about his synesthesia and wrote about it in some of his books. For example, in the green group there are alderleaf F, the unripe apple of P, and pistachio T. Dull green, combined somehow with violet, is the best I can do for W. The yellows comprise various E's and I's, creamy D, bright golden Y, and U, whose alphabetical value I can express only by brassy with an olive sheen. In the brown group, there are the rich rubbery tone of soft G, paler J, and the drab shoelace of H. Finally, among the reds, B has the tone called burnt sienna by painters, M is a fold of pink flannel, and today I have at last perfectly matched V with rose quartz in Mertz and Paul's Dictionary of Color. From Speak Memory, an Autobiography Revisited, 1966. He also pointed out that both his parents were synesthetes and seemed intrigued that his father saw K as yellow, his mother saw it as red, and he saw it as orange, a blend of the two. It isn't clear from his writings whether he regarded his blending as a coincidence, which it almost certainly is, or thought of it as a genuine hybridization of synesthesia. Poets and musicians also seem to enjoy a higher incidence of synesthesia. On his website, the psychologist Sean Day provides his translation of a passage from an 1895 German article that quotes the great musician Franz Liszt. When Liszt first began as Kapellmeister in Weimar, 1842, it astonished the orchestra that he said, "Oh, please, gentlemen, a little bluer, if you please. This tone type requires it." Or, "That is a deep violet, please. Depend on it." "Not so rose." First, the orchestra believed Liszt just joked. Later, they got accustomed to the fact that the great musician seemed to see colors there, where there were only tones. The French poet and synesthete Arthur Rimbaud wrote the poem Vowels, which begins, "A, black, E, white, I, red, U, green, O, blue. Vowels, I shall tell one day of your mysterious origins. A, black velvety jacket of brilliant flies, which buzz around cruel smells." According to one recent survey, as many as a third of all poets, novelists, and artists claim to have had synesthetic experiences of one sort or another, though a more conservative estimate would be 1 in 6. But is this simply because artists have vivid imaginations and are more apt to express themselves in metaphorical language? Or maybe they are just less inhibited about admitting having had such experiences? Or are they simply claiming to be synesthetes because it is sexy for an artist to be a synesthete? If the incidence is genuinely higher, why? One thing that poets and novelists have in common is that they are especially good at using metaphor. It is the East, and Juliet is the sun. It's as if their brains are better set up than the rest of ours to forge links between seemingly unrelated domains, like the sun and a beautiful young woman. When you hear Juliet is the sun, you don't say, "Oh, does that mean she is an enormous glowing ball of fire?" If asked to explain the metaphor, you instead say things like, "She is warm like the sun, nurturing like the sun, radiant like the sun, dispels darkness like the sun." Your brain instantly finds the right links, highlighting the most salient and beautiful aspects of Juliet. In other words, just as synesthesia involves making arbitrary links between seemingly unrelated perceptual entities, like colors and numbers, metaphor involves making non-arbitrary links between seemingly unrelated conceptual realms. Perhaps this isn't just a coincidence. The key to this puzzle is the observation that at least some high-level concepts are anchored, as we have seen, in specific brain regions. If you think about it, there is nothing more abstract than a number. Warren McCulloch, a founder of the cybernetics movement in the mid-20th century, once asked the rhetorical question, "What is a number that man may know it? And what is man that he may know number?" Yet there it is, number, neatly packaged in the small, tidy confines of the angular gyrus. When it is damaged, the patient can no longer do simple arithmetic. Brain damage can make a person lose the ability to name tools but not fruits and vegetables, or only fruits and not tools, or only fruits but not vegetables. All of these concepts are stored close to one another in the upper parts of the temporal lobes, but clearly they are sufficiently separated so that a small stroke can knock out one but leave the others intact. You might be tempted to think of fruits and tools as perceptions rather than concepts, but in fact, two tools, say a hammer and saw, can be visually as dissimilar from each other as they are from a banana. What unites them is a semantic understanding about their purpose and use. If ideas and concepts exist in the form of brain maps, perhaps we have the answer to our question about metaphor and creativity. If a mutation were to cause excess connections, or alternatively, to permit excess cross-leakage between different brain areas, then depending on where and how widely in the brain the trait was expressed, it could lead to both synesthesia and a heightened facility for linking seemingly unrelated concepts, words, images, or ideas. Gifted writers and poets may have excess connections between word and language areas. Gifted painters and graphic artists may have excess connections between high-level visual areas. Even a single word like Juliet or sun can be thought of as the center of a semantic whirlpool or of a rich swirl of associations. In the brain of a gifted wordsmith, excess connections would mean larger whirlpools, and therefore larger regions of overlap and a concomitantly higher propensity toward metaphor. This could explain the higher incidence of synesthesia in creative people in general. These ideas take us back full circle. Instead of saying synesthesia is more common among artists because they are being metaphorical, we should say they are better at metaphors because they are synesthetes.
This is the end of the CD. The audiobook continues on the next CD.
If you listen to your own conversations, you will be amazed to see how frequently metaphors pop up in ordinary speech. Pop up? See? Indeed, far from being mere decoration, the use of metaphor and our ability to uncover hidden analogies is the basis of all creative thought. Yet we know almost nothing about why metaphors are so evocative and how they are represented in the brain. Why is Juliet is the sun more effective than Juliet is a warm, radiantly beautiful woman? Is it simply economy of expression? Or is it because the mention of the sun automatically evokes a visceral feeling of warmth and light, making the description more vivid and in some sense real? Maybe metaphors allow you to carry out a sort of virtual reality in the brain. Bear in mind also that even warm and radiant are metaphors. Only beautiful isn't. There is no simple answer to this question, but we do know that some very specific brain mechanisms, even specific brain regions, might be critical, because the ability to use metaphors can be selectively lost in certain neurological and psychiatric disorders. For instance, in addition to experiencing difficulty using words and numbers, there are hints that people with damage to the left inferior parietal lobule, IPL, often also lose the ability to interpret metaphors and become extremely literal-minded. This hasn't been nailed down yet, but the evidence is compelling. If asked, what does a stitch in time saves nine mean? A patient with an IPL stroke might say, it's good to stitch up a hole in your shirt before it gets too large. He will completely miss the metaphorical meaning of the proverb, even when told explicitly that it is a proverb. This leads me to wonder whether the angular gyrus may have originally evolved for mediating cross-sensory associations and abstractions, but then, in humans, was co-opted for making all kinds of associations, including metaphorical ones. Metaphors seem paradoxical. On the one hand, a metaphor isn't literally true, and yet on the other hand, a well-turned metaphor seems to strike like lightning, revealing the truth more deeply or directly than a drab literal statement. I get chills whenever I hear Macbeth's immortal soliloquy from Act 5, Scene 5. Out, out, brief candle! Life's but a walking shadow, a poor player that struts and frets his hour upon the stage and then is heard no more. It is a tale told by an idiot, full of sound and fury, signifying nothing. Nothing he says is literal. He is not actually talking about candles or stagecraft or idiots. If taken literally, these lines really would be the ravings of an idiot. And yet these words are one of the most profound and deeply moving remarks about life that anyone has ever made. Puns, on the other hand, are based on superficial associations. Schizophrenics, who have miswired brains, are terrible at interpreting metaphors and proverbs. Yet, according to clinical folklore, they are very good at puns. This seems paradoxical because, after all, both metaphors and puns involve linking seemingly unrelated concepts. So why should schizophrenics be bad at the former, but good with the latter? The answer is that even though the two appear similar, puns are actually the opposite of metaphor. A metaphor exploits a surface-level similarity to reveal a deep hidden connection. A pun is a surface-level similarity that masquerades as a deep one, hence its comic appeal. What fun do monks have on Christmas? Answer, none. Perhaps a preoccupation with easy surface similarities erases or deflects attention from deeper connections. When I asked a schizophrenic what an elephant had in common with a man, he answered, they both carry a trunk, alluding maybe to the man's penis, or maybe to an actual trunk used for storage. Leaving puns aside, if my ideas about the link between synesthesia and metaphor are correct, then why isn't every synesthete highly gifted, or every great artist or poet, a synesthete? The reason may be that synesthesia might merely predispose you to be creative, but this does not mean other factors, both genetic and environmental, aren't involved in the full flowering of creativity. Even so, I would suggest that similar, though not identical, brain mechanisms might be involved in both phenomena, and so understanding one might help us understand the other. An analogy might be helpful. A rare blood disorder called sickle cell anemia is caused by a defective recessive gene that causes red blood cells to assume an abnormal sickle shape, making them unable to transport oxygen. this can be fatal. If you happen to inherit two copies of this gene, in the unlikely event that both your parents had either the trait or the disease itself, then you develop the full-blown disease. However, if you inherit just one copy of this gene, you do not come down with the disease, though you can still pass it on to your children. Now, it turns out that, although sickle cell anemia is extremely rare in most parts of the world, where natural selection has effectively weeded it out, its incidence is 10 times higher in certain parts of Africa. Why should this be? The surprising answer is that the sickle cell trait actually seems to protect the affected individual from malaria, a disease caused by a mosquito-borne parasite that infects and destroys blood cells. This protection conferred on the population as a whole from malaria outweighs the reproductive disadvantage caused by the occasional rare appearance of an individual with double copies of the sickle cell gene. Thus, the apparently maladaptive gene has actually been selected for by evolution, but only in geographic locations where malaria is endemic. A similar argument has been proposed for the relatively high incidence of schizophrenia and bipolar disorder in humans. The reason these disorders have not been weeded out may be because having some of the genes that lead to the full-blown disorder are advantageous, perhaps boosting creativity, intelligence, or subtle social-emotional faculties. Thus, humanity as a whole benefits from keeping these genes in its gene pool, but the unfortunate side effect is a sizable minority who get bad combinations of them. Carrying this logic forward, the same could well be true for synesthesia. We have seen how, by dint of anatomy, genes that lead to enhanced cross-activation between brain areas could have been highly advantageous by making us creative as a species. Certain uncommon variants or combinations of these genes might have the benign side effect of producing synesthesia. I hasten to emphasize the part about benign. Synesthesia is not deleterious, like sickle cell disease and mental illness, and in fact, most synesthetes seem to really enjoy their abilities and would not opt to have them cured, even if they could. This is only to say that the general mechanism might be the same. This idea is important because it makes clear that synesthesia and metaphor are not synonymous, and yet they share a deep connection that might give us deep insights into our marvelous uniqueness. Thus, synesthesia is best thought of as an example of subpathological cross-modal interactions that could be a signature or marker for creativity. A modality is a sensory faculty, such as smell, touch, or hearing. Cross-modal refers to sharing information between senses, as when your vision and hearing together tell you that you're watching a badly dubbed foreign film. But as often happens in science, it got me thinking about the fact that even in those of us who are non-synesthetes, a great deal of what goes on in our mind depends on entirely normal cross-modal interactions that are not arbitrary. So there is a sense in which, at some level, we are all synesthetes. For example, look at the two shapes in Figure 3-7. The one on the left looks like a paint splat. The one on the right resembles a jagged piece of shattered glass. Now let me ask you, if you had to guess, which of these is a booba and which is a kiki? There is no right answer, but odds are you picked the splat as booba and the glass as kiki. I tried this in a large classroom recently, and 98% of the students made this choice. Now you might think this has something to do with the blob resembling the physical form of the letter B, for booba, and the jagged thing resembling a K, as in kiki. But if you tried the experiment on non-English-speaking people in India or China, where the writing systems are completely different, you find exactly the same thing. Why does this happen? The reason is that the gentle curves and undulations of contour on the amoeba-like figure metaphorically, one might say, mimic the gentle undulations of the sound booba, as represented in the hearing centers in the brain, and in the smooth rounding and relaxing of the lips for producing the curved booba sound. On the other hand, The sharp waveforms of the sound kiki and the sharp inflection of the tongue on the palate mimic the sudden changes in the jagged visual shape. We will return to this demonstration in Chapter 6 and see how it might hold the key to understanding many of the most mysterious aspects of our minds, such as the evolution of metaphor, language, and abstract thought. I have argued so far that synesthesia, and in particular the existence of higher forms of synesthesia, involving abstract concepts rather than concrete sensory qualities, can provide clues to understanding some of the high-level thought processes that humans alone are capable of. Can we apply these ideas to what is arguably the loftiest of our mental traits, mathematics? Mathematicians often speak of seeing numbers laid out in space, roaming this abstract realm to discover hidden relationships that others might have missed, such as Fermat's Last Theorem or Goldbach's Conjecture. Numbers in space? Are they being metaphorical? One day in 1997, after I had consumed a glass of sherry, I had a flash of insight, or at least I thought I had. Most of the insights I have when inebriated turn out to be false alarms. In his original Nature paper, Galton described a second type of synesthesia that is even more intriguing than the number color condition. He called it number forms. Other researchers used the phrase number line. If I asked you to visualize the numbers 1 to 10 in your mind's eye, you will probably report a vague tendency to see them mapped in space sequentially, left to right, as you were taught in grade school. But number line synesthetes are different. They are able to visualize numbers vividly and do not see the numbers arranged sequentially from left to right, but on a snaking, twisting line that can even double back on itself, so that 36 might be closer to 23, say, than it is to 38. Figure 3-8. One could think of this as number-space synesthesia, in which every number is always in a particular location in space. The number line for any individual remains constant, even if tested on intervals separated by months. As with all experiments in psychology, we needed a method to prove Galton's observation experimentally. I called upon my students Ed Hubbard and Shai Azulai to help set up the procedures. We first decided to look at the well-known number distance effect seen in normal people. Cognitive psychologists have examined every conceivable variation of the effect on hapless student volunteers, but its relevance to number space synesthesia was missed until we came along. Ask anyone which of two numbers is larger, 5 or 7, 12 or 50. Anyone who has been through grade school will get it right every time. The interesting part comes when you clock how long it takes people to spit out each of their answers. This latency between showing them a number pair and their verbal response is their reaction time, RT. It turns out that the greater the distance between two numbers, the shorter the RT, and contrarywise, the closer two numbers are, the longer it takes to form an answer. This suggests that your brain represents numbers in some sort of actual mental number line, which you consult visually to determine which is greater. Numbers that are far apart can be easily eyeballed, while numbers that are close together need closer inspection, which takes a few extra milliseconds. We realized we could exploit this paradigm to see if the convoluted number line phenomenon really existed or not. We could ask a number space synesthete to compare number pairs and see if her RTs corresponded to the real conceptual distance between numbers or would reflect the idiosyncratic geometry of her own personal number line. In 2001, we managed to recruit an Austrian student named Petra, who was a number space synesthete. Her highly convoluted number line doubled back on itself so that, for example, 21 was spatially closer to 36 than it was to 18. Ed and I were very excited. As of that time, there had not been any study on the number space phenomenon since the time when Galton discovered it in 1867. No attempt had been made to establish its authenticity or to suggest what causes it. So any new information, we realized, would be valuable. At least we could get the ball rolling. We hooked Petra up to a machine that measured her RT to questions such as, which is bigger, 36 or 38? Or, on a different trial, 36 or 23. As often happens in science, the result wasn't entirely clear one way or the other. Petra's RT seemed to depend partially on the numerical distance and partially on spatial distance. This wasn't the conclusive result we had hoped for, but it did suggest that her number line representation wasn't entirely left to right and linear as it is in normal brains. Some aspects of number representation in her brain were clearly messed up. We published our finding in 2003 in a volume devoted to synesthesia, and it inspired much subsequent research. The results have been mixed, but at the very least, we revived interest in an old problem that had been largely ignored by the pundits, and we suggested ways of testing it objectively. Shai Azulai and I followed up with a second experiment on two new number-space synesthetes that was designed to prove the same point. This time we used a memory test. We asked each synesthete to remember sets of nine numbers, for example, 13, 6, 8, 18, 22, 10, 15, 2, 24, displayed randomly on various spatial locations on the screen. The experiment contained two conditions. In condition A, nine random numbers were scattered randomly about the two-dimensional screen. In condition B, each number was placed where it should be on each synesthete's personal convoluted line as if it had been projected or flattened onto the screen. We had initially interviewed each subject to find out the geometry of his or her personal number line and determined which numbers the subject placed close to each other within that idiosyncratic coordinate system. In each condition, the subjects were asked to view the display for 30 seconds in order to memorize the numbers. After a few minutes, they were simply asked to report all the numbers they could recall having seen. The result was striking. The most accurate recall was for the numbers they had seen in condition B. Again, we had shown that these people's personal number lines were real. If they weren't, or if their shapes varied across time, why should it matter where the numbers had been placed? Putting the numbers where they should be in each synesthete's personal number line apparently facilitated that person's memory for the numbers, something you wouldn't see in a normal person. One more observation deserves special mention. Some of our number-space synesthetes told us spontaneously that the shape of their personal number lines strongly influenced their ability to do arithmetic. In particular, subtraction or division, but not multiplication, which again is memorized by rote, was much more difficult across sudden, sharp kinks in their lines than it was along relatively straight portions of it. On the other hand, some creative mathematicians have told me that their twisted number lines enable them to see hidden relationships between numbers that elude us lesser mortals. This observation convinced me that both mathematical savants and creative mathematicians are not being merely metaphorical when they speak of wandering a spatial landscape of numbers. They are seeing relationships that are not obvious to us less gifted mortals. As for how these convoluted number lines come to exist in the first place, that is still hard to explain. A number represents many things. 11 apples, 11 minutes, the 11th day of Christmas, but what they have in common are the semi-separate notions of order and quantity. These are very abstract qualities, and our apish brains surely were not under selective pressure to handle mathematics per se. Studies of hunter-gatherer societies suggest that our prehistoric ancestors probably had names for a few small numbers, perhaps up to 10, the number of our fingers, but more advanced and flexible counting systems are cultural inventions of historical times. There simply wouldn't have been enough for the brain to evolve a lookup table or number module starting from scratch. On the other hand, no pun intended, the brain's representation of space is almost as ancient as mental faculties come. Given the opportunistic nature of evolution, it is possible that the most convenient way to represent abstract numerical ideas, including sequentiality, is to map them onto a pre-existing map of visual space. Given that the parietal lobe originally evolved to represent space, is it a surprise that numerical calculations are also computed there, especially in the angular gyrus? This is a prime example of what might have been a unique step in human evolution. In the spirit of taking a speculative leap, I would like to argue that further specialization might have occurred in our space-mapping parietal lobes. The left angular gyrus might be involved in representing ordinality. The right angular gyrus might be specialized for quantity. The simplest way to spatially map out a numerical sequence in the brain would be a straight line from left to right. This, in turn, might be mapped onto notions of quantity represented in the right hemisphere. But now let's assume that the gene that allows such remapping of sequence on visual space is mutated. The result might be a convoluted number line of the kind you see in number space synesthetes. If I were to guess, I'd say other types of sequence, such as months or weeks, are also housed in the left angular gyrus. If this is correct, we should expect that a patient with a stroke in this area might have difficulty in quickly telling you whether, for example, Wednesday comes after or before Tuesday. Someday, I hope to meet such a patient. About 3 months after I had embarked on synesthesia research, I encountered a strange twist. I received an email from one of my undergraduate students, Spike Jayan. I opened it, expecting to find the usual "please reconsider my grade" request, but it turned out that he's a number-color synesthete who had read about our work and wanted to be tested. Nothing strange so far, but then he dropped a bombshell. He's colorblind. A colorblind synesthete. My mind began to reel. If he experiences colors, are they anything like the colors you or I experience? Could synesthesia shed light on that ultimate human mystery, conscious awareness? Color vision is a remarkable thing. Even though most of us can experience millions of subtly different hues, it turns out our eyes use only three kinds of color photoreceptors, called cones, to represent all of them. As we saw in Chapter 2, each cone contains a pigment that responds optimally to just one color, red, green, or blue. Although each type of cone responds optimally to only one specific wavelength, it will also respond, to a lesser extent, to other wavelengths that are close to the optimum. For example, red cones respond vigorously to red light, fairly well to orange, weakly to yellow, and hardly at all to green or blue. Green cones respond best to green, less well to yellowish green, and even less to yellow. Thus, every specific wavelength of visible light stimulates your red, green, and blue cones by a specific amount. There are literally millions of possible three-way combinations, and your brain knows how to interpret each one as a separate color. Color blindness is a congenital condition in which one or more of these pigments is deficient or absent. A colorblind person's vision works perfectly normally in nearly every respect, but she can see only a limited range of hues. Depending on which cone pigment is lost and on the extent of loss, she may be red-green colorblind or blue-yellow colorblind. In rare cases, two pigments are deficient, and the person sees purely in black and white. Spike had the red-green variety. He experienced far fewer colors in the world than most of us do. What was truly bizarre, though, was that he often saw numbers tinged with colors that he had never seen in the real world. He referred to them, quite charmingly and appropriately, as Martian colors that were weird and seemed quite unreal. He could only see these when looking at numbers. Ordinarily, one would be tempted to ignore such remarks as being crazy, but in this case, the explanation was staring me in the face. I realized that my theory about cross-activation of brain maps provides a neat explanation for this bizarre phenomenon. Remember, Spike's cone receptors are deficient, but the problem is entirely in his eyes. His retinas are unable to send the full normal range of color signals up to the brain, but in all likelihood, his cortical color processing areas, such as V4 in the fusiform, are perfectly normal. At the same time, he is a number color synesthete. Thus, number shapes are processed normally, all the way up to his fusiform, and then, due to cross-wiring, produce cross-activation of cells in his V4 color area. Since Spike has never experienced his missing colors in the real world, and can do so only by looking at numbers, he finds them incredibly strange. Incidentally, this observation also demolishes the idea that synesthesia arises from early childhood memory associations, such as having played with colored magnets. For how can someone remember a color he has never seen? After all, there are no magnets painted with Martian colors. It is worth pointing out that non-colorblind synesthetes may also see Martian colors. Some describe letters of the alphabet as being composed of multiple colors simultaneously, layered on top of each other, making them not quite fit the standard taxonomy of colors. This phenomenon probably arises from mechanisms similar to those observed in Spike. The colors look weird because the connections in his visual pathways are weird, and thus uninterpretable. What is it like to experience colors that don't appear anywhere in the rainbow, colors from another dimension? Imagine how frustrating it must be to sense something you cannot describe. Could you explain what it feels like to see blue to a person who has been blind from birth, or the smell of Marmite to an Indian, or saffron to an Englishman? It raises the old philosophical conundrum of whether we can ever really know what someone else is experiencing. Many a student has asked the seemingly naive question, "How do I know that your red isn't my blue?" Synesthesia reminds us that this question may not be that naive after all. As you may recall from earlier, the term for referring to the ineffable subjective quality of conscious experience is qualia. These questions about whether other people's qualia are similar to our own, or different, or possibly absent, may seem as pointless as asking how many angels can dance on the head of a pin, but I remain hopeful. Philosophers have struggled with these questions for centuries, but here at last, with our blooming knowledge about synesthesia, a tiny crack in the door of this mystery may be opening. This is the way science works. Begin with simple, clearly formulated, tractable questions that can pave the way for eventually answering the big questions, such as, what are qualia? What is the self? And even, what is consciousness? Synesthesia might be able to give us some clues to these abiding mysteries, because it provides a way of selectively activating some visual areas while skipping or bypassing others. It is not ordinarily possible to do this. So instead of asking the somewhat nebulous questions, what is consciousness and what is the self, we can refine our approach to the problem by focusing on just one aspect of consciousness, our awareness of visual sensations, and ask ourselves, does conscious awareness of redness require activation of all or most of the 30 areas in the visual cortex? Or only a small subset of them? What about the whole cascade of activity from the retina to the thalamus to the primary visual cortex before the messages get relayed to the 30 higher visual areas? Is their activity also required for conscious experience, or can you skip them and directly activate V4 and experience an equally vivid red? If you look at a red apple, you would ordinarily activate the visual area for both color, red, and form, apple-like. But what if you could artificially stimulate the color area without stimulating cells concerned with form? Would you experience disembodied red color floating out there in front of you like a mass of amorphous ectoplasm or other spooky stuff? And lastly, we also know that there are many more neural projections going backward from each level in the hierarchy of visual processing to earlier areas than there are going forward. The function of these back projections is completely unknown. Is their activity required for conscious awareness of red? What if you could selectively silence them with a chemical while you looked at a red apple? Would you lose awareness? These questions come perilously close to being the kind of impossible-to-do armchair thought experiments that philosophers revel in. The key difference is that such experiments really can be done, maybe within our lifetimes. And then we may finally understand why apes care about nothing beyond ripe fruit and red rumps, while we are drawn to the stars. Chapter 4. The Neurons That Shaped Civilization. Even when we are alone, how often do we think with pain and pleasure of what others think of us, or their imagined approbation or disapprobation? And this all follows from sympathy, a fundamental element of the social instincts. Charles Darwin. A fish knows how to swim the instant it hatches, and off it darts to fend for itself. When a duckling hatches, it can follow its mother over land and across the water within moments. Foals, still dripping with amniotic fluid, spend a few minutes bucking around to get the feel of their legs, then join the herd. Not so with humans. We come out limp and squalling and utterly dependent on round-the-clock care and supervision. We mature glacially and do not approach anything resembling adult competence for many, many years. Obviously, we must gain some very large advantage from this costly, not to mention risky, upfront investment, and we do. It's called culture. In this chapter, I explore how a specific class of brain cells, called mirror neurons, may have played a pivotal role in our becoming the one and only species that veritably lives and breathes culture. Culture consists of massive collections of complex skills and knowledge which are transferred from person to person through two core mediums, language and imitation. We would be nothing without our savant-like ability to imitate others. Accurate imitation, in turn, may depend on the uniquely human ability to adopt another's point of view, both visually and metaphorically, and may have required a more sophisticated deployment of these neurons compared with how they are organized in the brains of monkeys. The ability to see the world from another person's vantage point is also essential for constructing a mental model of another person's complex thoughts and intentions in order to predict and manipulate his behavior. Sam thinks I don't realize that Martha hurt him. This capacity, called theory of mind, is unique to humans. Finally, certain aspects of language itself, that vital medium of cultural transmission, was probably built at least partly on our facility for imitation. Darwin's theory of evolution is one of the most important scientific discoveries of all time. Unfortunately, however, the theory makes no provision for an afterlife. Consequently, it has provoked more acrimonious debate than any other topic in science, so much so that some school districts in the United States have insisted on giving the theory of intelligent design, which is really just a fig leaf for creationism, equal status in textbooks. As has been pointed out repeatedly by the British scientist and social critic Richard Dawkins, this is little different from giving equal status to the idea that the sun goes around Earth. At the time evolutionary theory was proposed, long before the discovery of DNA and the molecular machinery of life, back when paleontology had just barely begun to piece together the fossil record, the gaps in our knowledge were sufficiently large to leave room for honest doubt. That point is long past, but that doesn't mean we have solved the entire puzzle. It would be arrogant for a scientist to deny that there are still many important questions about the evolution of the human mind and brain that remain unanswered. At the top of my list would be the following. 1. The hominin brain reached nearly its present size and perhaps even its present intellectual capacity about 300,000 years ago. Yet many of the attributes we regard as uniquely human, such as tool-making, fire-building, art, music, and perhaps even full-blown language, appeared only much later, around 75,000 years ago. Why? What was the brain doing during that long incubation period? Why did it take so long for all this latent potential to blossom, and then why did it blossom so suddenly? Given that natural selection can only select expressed abilities, not latent ones, how did all this latent potential get built up in the first place? I shall call this Wallace's problem, after the Victorian naturalist Alfred Russel Wallace, who first proposed it when discussing the origins of language. The lowest savages, with the least copious vocabularies, have the capacity of uttering a variety of distinct articulate sounds and of applying them to an almost infinite amount of modulation and inflection, which is not in any way inferior to that of the higher European races. An instrument has been developed in advance of the needs of its possessor. 2. Crude Oldowan tools, made by just a few blows to a core stone to create an irregular edge, emerged 2.4 million years ago and were probably made by Homo habilis, whose brain size was halfway between that of chimps and modern humans. After another million years of evolutionary stasis, aesthetically pleasing symmetrical tools began to appear, which reflected a standardization of production technique. These required switching from a hard hammer to a soft, perhaps wooden hammer while the tool was being made, so as to ensure a smooth rather than a jagged, irregular edge. And lastly, the invention of stereotyped assembly line tools, sophisticated symmetrical bifacial tools that were hafted to a handle, took place only 200,000 years ago. Why was the evolution of the human mind punctuated by these relatively sudden upheavals of technological change? What was the role of tool use in shaping human cognition? 3. Why was there a sudden explosion, what Jared Diamond, in his book Guns, Germs, and Steel, calls the Great Leap, in mental sophistication around 60,000 years ago? This is when widespread cave art, clothing, and constructed dwellings appeared. Why did these advances come along only then, even though the brain had achieved its modern size almost a million years earlier? It's the Wallace problem again. 4. Humans are often called the Machiavellian primate, referring to our ability to predict other people's behavior and outsmart them. Why are we humans so good at reading one another's intentions? Do we have a specialized brain module or circuit for generating a theory of other minds, as proposed by the British cognitive neuroscientists Nicholas Humphrey, Uta Frith, Mark Hauser, and Simon Baron-Cohen? Where is this circuit, and when did it evolve? Is it present in some rudimentary form in monkeys and apes? And if so, what makes ours so much more sophisticated than theirs? 5. How did language evolve? Unlike many other human traits, such as humor, art, dancing, and music, the survival value of language is obvious. It lets us communicate our thoughts and intentions. But the question of how such an extraordinary ability actually came into being has puzzled biologists, psychologists, and philosophers since at least Darwin's time. One problem is that the human vocal apparatus is vastly more sophisticated than that of any other ape, but without the correspondingly sophisticated language areas in the human brain, such exquisite articulatory equipment alone would be useless. So how did these two mechanisms, with so many elegant interlocking parts, evolve in tandem? Following Darwin's lead, I suggest that our vocal equipment and our remarkable ability to modulate our voice evolved mainly for producing emotional calls and musical sounds during courtship in early primates, including our hominin ancestors. Once that evolved, the brain, especially the left hemisphere, could start using it for language. But an even bigger puzzle remains. Is language mediated by a sophisticated and highly specialized mental language organ that is unique to humans and that emerged completely out of the blue, as suggested by the famous MIT linguist Noam Chomsky? Or was there a more primitive gestural communication system already in place that provided scaffolding for the emergence of vocal language? A major piece of the solution to this riddle comes from the discovery of mirror neurons. I have already alluded to mirror neurons in earlier chapters and will return to them again in Chapter 6, but here in the context